Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our great guest host, Dr. Jamil Battle. Welcome.
Welcome.
You know, today we have a really fascinating show. We're going to be talking with Dr. Paul Offit, pediatrician and professor at the University of Pennsylvania, about his new book called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Do you ever listen to the health celebrity advice like Dr. Oz?
I'm a scientist, so I'm a skeptic.
Yeah, I think that we would probably be in agreement. We'll probably be in agreement with Dr. Offit, but really looking forward to his expertise. First, let's actually talk about some research that matters. And this first one, I think, is really important. And it's about what's called white coat hypertension. What is that?
So white coat hypertension is when your blood pressure is elevated in the office, but it is normal at home. And this was a large meta-analysis that looked at this condition. And what they found is that more than twice more likely to die from a cardiac event who had the white coat hypertension.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we a lot of times think about, oh, it's just when your blood pressure is elevated. You come to the doctor, you're kind of nervous. We understand that. And then when you leave the doctor, your blood pressure is okay. The problem is, are you like nervous a lot? So you're walking in different situation and your blood pressure goes up. And there's a subset of people who, while their blood pressure may be true normal when they're at home resting, it's elevated a lot of the time and they actually have high blood pressure. Those people need to be treated versus the group that they only happens when they go in the doctor. And that's only once a year and they're fine and they don't need to be treated. And the excess mortality was in that first group, the ones that really have it versus the group that really doesn't have it.
And I think this finding actually calls into question really the proper treatment for white coat hypertension. And doctors really should monitor patients more closely that have white coat hypertension.
Yeah, I think the gold standard is what's called an ambulatory blood pressure monitor. And increasingly, insurance companies do pay for that. And I think the devices are going to get better and easier. And you wear it for 24 hours and you see what it's like when you're sleeping and when you're awake. I had a patient do one this week because I was worried that they actually had real high blood pressure, not just the white coat hypertension. And sure enough, they did. Their blood pressure was up maybe 60% of the time, and that's enough to take medication to prevent the outcomes we're seeing in this particular study.
That's right. Preventing cardiac events like strokes and heart attacks definitely save lives and saves healthcare dollars. And I think it's far more than what a device would cost over time.
Moreover, it doesn't mean you're going to be on medication. It may be that you just need to lose weight, quit drinking alcohol, exercise more, and quit smoking. Things that we know are difficult but yet can be life-saving and avoid the need for medication.
Great point.
Let's talk about the next research that matters. And how many have a loved one that's being cared for by an aide or have had an aide care for a loved one? I bet it's in the millions of people around the United States.
I bet so, too. With baby boomers increasing in age, roughly 2.9 million home health and personal care workers are currently in the space, and there's a projected 1.2 million to join the workforce by 2026. But why was this study particularly important?
Well, I think what they're really trying to see, and I wholeheartedly agree, is we know that a lot of the patients that are getting these services have dementia or other behavioral problems. And the question is, are the caregivers actually going to be subjected to abuse by the patients? And if they are, what are we doing to help protect the caregivers? And they actually interviewed home care workers in 3,000 home care visits to see about verbal abuse, such as being spoken to, angry, making them feel bad about themselves, maybe a racial, ethnic, religious insult or threat of violence, and also physical abuse. Mm-hmm. What did they find?
So they found that close to 1 in 4 said that they had been verbally abused at least once over the last 12 months. Half of those people said they had even experienced more than one type of verbal abuse. And 1 in 20 said they had experienced all 4 kinds. That these home care workers who were verbally abused were 11 times more likely to be physically abused even. And that older workers over 48 were less likely to be abused, suggesting maybe that the older workers maybe just had more experience. But the factors that really stood out for increasing the risk of abuse was having a patient with dementia, working in a home with little space to perform the care, and having an unpredictable work schedule.
Yeah, and I think the biggest one is, and the highest risk really, are these close confines with someone who has some behavioral health problems and an aide who may not have extensive training in dealing with this. So I think providing that support, you know, thank you so much for the care you're giving, appreciate it greatly, and then try to be supportive because you don't want that aide to burn out.
That's right, particularly since we need our aides and we need these healthcare workers. The self-care and the resilience, given that our population's aging. I think the importance is maybe spelling out a policy as to what to do when the staff feels threatened and providing additional protection and support for our workers and the clients.
This next research that matters, I think, is probably something we all could use, which is, are there benefits for getting out in nature for a couple hours a week? Believe it or not, someone's done research on it.
Yeah, that's right. And this was a fascinating study published in Scientific Reports. And this study pulled data from nearly 20,000 people in England. And what they found is at least 120 minutes in nature a week are significantly more likely to report good health, higher psychological well-being than those who didn't visit nature.
One of the things that made me a little dubious about this research was that if it was less than 120, there was no benefit. I'm like, I don't know. It seems like it should be like the more is the better, you know?
And right.
So, but it's interesting to think about. And for those of us who are maybe like lots of doctors who are inside walls all day long, you know, 50 to 60 hours a week, it reminds us that maybe getting out, smelling the trees, hearing the birds, feeling the warmth of nature has really positive health benefits.
And the mechanism here, I would be fascinated to understand more about. Maybe it's just having more time to think or more time to connect with friends or family, reduce your stress, things like that.
I know when I went outside today on my way over to the studio, I just felt this sense of warmth because it was cold inside. It was nice and warm outside. But also, I just felt like my stress level had gone down just being outside. Mm-hmm. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Paul Offit, pediatrician and professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of a new book called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golson and Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Paul Offit, pediatrician, professor at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, about his recent book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Offit.
Thank you.
You know, I must say, your title is provocative, and we'll definitely want to do a deep dive into the book, but we'd like to do a little bit of a deep dive into you because you have a very interesting career to being a journalist. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in medicine and pediatrics and ultimately even vaccines.
I think the real answer to that question is I got interested in medicine because I was hospitalized as a 5-year-old for a series of problems. One was I was born with club feet. That was a congenital abnormality that never healed, and at least appropriately as far as the doctor was concerned. So I had an operation on my right foot, which had me in basically a polio ward for about 6 weeks. So I certainly saw what polio looked like in the mid-1950s. Plus, there was one visiting hour a week, so I virtually never saw my parents. And I think it just seared in my brain these children who were sort of vulnerable and helpless and alone. And so I think it was part of it, and probably the part of the draw for infectious diseases. I also ruptured my spleen when I was 5 years of age, so that required emergency surgery. So I was in the hospital a lot as a five-year-old. I lived, which is, I guess, why we're talking now, but that did have an effect on me. And then I think that I thought I would be a pediatrician, but I was sort of compelled by infectious diseases as a pediatric resident. And then I thought I would be just a pediatrician with infectious disease expertise, but then I really enjoyed research. So I ended up spending 25 years in a laboratory creating the strains that became the rotavirus vaccine, Rotatec. And that was just, you know, just a lot of fun. And then I think in the process, I sort of learned how difficult it was to make vaccines and how easy it was to dam them. And I think with that, I started writing medical narratives about vaccines, and we created our Vaccine Education Center for that reason.
Fascinating background. What led you to write Bad Advice as a segue into this conversation?
I think I was just an innocent abroad, I guess, to use Mark Twain's term. I never really had media training. I started to be called on by the media, like, you know, not just print media like New York Times and Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, but, you know, but Samantha Bee when she was on The Daily Show, and Stephen Colbert with the Colbert Report, and morning and evening shows. And I just learned a lot along the way. I think the purpose of this book is in part trying to be humorous, at least I think I was being humorous, you know, to talk about sort of the challenges, I think, for someone like me who's really a basic scientist and physician, trying to navigate through the media and through the opaque window that I think is the media when you're trying to communicate science in a compelling and passionate and compassionate way. I think in this book is a lot of slips and falls on my part, and hopefully people won't make the same mistakes I did.
It sounds like there's something more fundamentally happening, at least you believe, within the sphere of kind of the public domain and the time of sound bites that can be harmful. Give us an example where you think sometimes harm is done from maybe celebrities who are talking about things that are maybe not reducible to a soundbite.
Sure. Well, we give celebrities a platform. I think, you know, and they know that. We think we know them. We see them on the big screen or the television screen, and we think we know them. We think that they are the characters they play. That's why celebrities are used to sell products and scientists are not used to sell products. But I think with that platform comes responsibility, and sometimes they don't take that responsibility. In answer to sort of the second part of your question, yes, it's very hard to take a complex scientific issue and reduce it to a soundbite, which is what you're asked to do on television. Well, it's a little easier to do these things on radio or newspapers, which are a little longer format, so you don't have to, you know, tell people why it is that an ethyl mercury preservative in vaccines wouldn't be harmful to their child in 10 seconds. So that's difficult to reduce complex thoughts into 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But you're wanting to hold people accountable for what they're transmitting.
Yes, I think those who choose to use their platform to stand up and give false information, misleading information, to give them bad information that causes them to make bad decisions that put their children in harm's way is unconscionable. I mean, we have several children in New York right now who are in intensive care unit with measles. And, you know, there's so much we can't do in medicine. There's so much we don't know in medicine. But this we do know. Specific germs cause specific diseases. We can prevent some of those occasionally deadly pathogens. And so we do. And you know, we eliminated measles from the United States by the year 2000. The only reason it's back is because a critical number of people are choosing not to vaccinate their children. And they're making that choice based on bad information.
How can we hold them more accountable or more responsible?
Call them out. A lot of people do that, not just me, but a number of other people who stand up for vaccines. Make sure that you know, I think traditionally what we do, and you know this better than me, is we stand up for the science. We, you know, vaccines are good, vaccine preventable diseases are bad. I think it's okay to pull back the curtain and say, you know, those who stand up and say things that are potentially harmful or at least put children in harm's way should be held accountable for what they say. But it is a, you know, we live in a country with a First Amendment, and you have a free press here. You can say things that you want. And although I would argue that when you say vaccines, for example, cause autism, when it's clear from the data that they don't, that is the equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded movie theater, and that isn't your First Amendment right. I don't think it's your First Amendment right to scare people who would then put their children in harm's way. So But again, it's a hard argument to make.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking, you know, actually to what we do on our radio show, which is we talk about research that matters. And a lot of time the research is designed or not designed, but the outcomes of the research show that people need to quit doing some things actually because it's not helping them. Like for the vast majority of the population, multivitamins don't seem to have any benefit, but yet there's $1 billion, multi-billion-dollar industry marketing it to them. How do we ensure that bad advice gets labeled as bad and good advice that can improve people's health is labeled as good?
Right. Great question. I mean, I wrote a book called Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine, where I devote a whole chapter, not just to the fact that multivitamins at best make for a lot of expensive urine, but that, you know, that these large quantities of antioxidants, like vitamins A and E and, you know, minerals like selenium, can actually be harmful. It's not just a matter that they don't help, they can hurt. And so I wrote that book and certainly was in a lot of national newscasts about that book, but the fact remains that you are leaning up into a marketing industry that you know, spends millions and tens of millions of dollars marketing their product, and you know that's what you're up against, and it's hard. I mean, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal after yet another article came out showing that large quantities of vitamin E actually increase your risk of prostate cancer. The headline of that article was, "Is this the end of popping vitamins?" Wall Street Journal, right? But there was a quote in that article that I think said it all. It was from, I think, the CEO of the GNC Corporation, which said, you know, these studies don't have any effect on our business. We can essentially market it away. And that's what you're up against.
Oh, wow. Do you think there are ways that these public figures who aren't scientists can help maybe further good science?
And they do. There are certainly people like Amanda Peet or Carrie Russell, Jennifer Lopez. I mean, there are a number of celebrities who have stood up for vaccines, but you'd like to think that's not what it comes down to. Like, mm-hmm. We're like our celebrities versus their celebrities. I mean, in a better world, and we're not living in that world right now, that people would trust science. And we did. I really do think there was a time in this country where we trusted scientists, we trusted people who had expertise and experience, but we sort of drifted away from that. There's a great book, actually, by Kurt Anderson called Fantasyland that kind of goes through how we got to this point where people can simply declare their own truths. I mean, including mm-hmm. the current administration. Vaccines cause autism, creationism and evolution are equally valid hypotheses. Climate change isn't real or is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I mean, you just get to make it up, and there is a critical percentage of the population who will believe you.
Mm-hmm. It's not a hoax made by the Chinese?
No, I don't think so. I think it's real. Human activity actually does affect our environment.
Got to have a little bit of the humor in there. We're gonna need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Paul Offit, pediatrician, professor at University of Pennsylvania, director of the Vaccine Education Center, and author of a new book called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Paul Offit, University of Pennsylvania, and director of the Vaccine Education Center, as well as the author of a new book called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. And Dr. Offit, right before the break, I think you were giving us kind of some insights into kind of responsible science, responsible reporting. And it made me think a little bit about, you know, we hear about fake news and the journalists are all struggling to get their word out. And I see the fact checkers, and those fact checkers seem to have some traction whereby we can rapidly say, is this true or not true? And I wonder if, you know, your bad advice, I can almost see something coming across our desk each day and going, bad advice, bad advice, not true. Do we need, I mean, that would be sound bite-ish, but it might help us differentiate.
No, I think that's right. I do think there is a journalistic mantra which works against good science, which is the mantra of balance, which is to say you tell two sides of a story when only one side is supported by the science. And that, I think that was much more true, at least in the vaccine realm 10 or 15 years ago. You always have the other side, the parent who said, look, my child was fine, they got this vaccine, now they have autism. And they always felt compelled to tell that quote-unquote side of the story. And I would argue that the mantra shouldn't be one of balance. It should be one of perspective, that it's okay, for example, in this example, to take the notion that vaccines are a cultural controversy, but they're not a scientific controversy. I mean, vaccines don't cause autism, and that should be very clear in these articles, and at least, I think, 10 or 15 years ago, it wasn't clear. I do think that, though, the mainstream media, anyway, has evolved to telling the story right now. I do think the vaccine wars are currently being fought mostly on social media, not on mainstream media.
Well, do you have any advice on perhaps how you would advocate for scientists to basically become their own public kind of advocate for health literacy and getting good advice across?
Right. Well, I mean, I would say, I mean, as a basic scientist, I would say that my training as a basic scientist was the opposite of media training. You know, what you're asked to do in the media is be clear and definitive. Vaccines don't cause autism. Technically, you can't really do a study that ever shows that. You know, epidemiological studies are not proofs. They're not mathematical theorems. You know, you formulate a hypothesis. You can reject it or not reject it, but you can't ever accept the null hypothesis, which is to say you can never prove never. And when you listen to scientists talk on the radio or television, you hear that in their voice. They'll say, well, the evidence to date doesn't support the hypothesis that, you know, this is causing this. And whereas the other side is saying, hey, this causes this. And I think we have to be better at realizing how science sounds when we talk to non-scientists. I mean, a good scientific paper has a discussion section that is full of caveats. That is not a good interview.
What was kind of surprising to you or unexpected? You know, when you write a book, you learn yourself things. What's something you learned that you just wouldn't have thought of otherwise?
A couple of things. I think one is the comedians are great. You know, I think the old line, I think it was Oscar Wilde, was if you're going to tell people the truth, make them laugh, otherwise they'll kill you. And I think that's been the comedians. They, and take your pick, Jimmy Kimmel, Stephen Colbert, Samantha Bee, Penn and Teller, John Oliver, have all been uniformly great on vaccine. And I think the reason is because they're skeptics. I think they're very good at knowing or seeing nonsense and recognizing it for what it is. And so they have been uniformly great on this. Plus, they have influence over, I think, the younger viewer. So that's good. But the other thing is that there have been journalists that I've run into, even on network television, which tends to, you know, select for a group that's a little more superficial, who have been great. I mean, Gayle King, when I was on CBS This Morning, usually when people review a book, and that was actually Do You Believe in Magic, you know, you're just happy if they've read the flap of your book, you know, but she had read, you know, the whole book. She had tabs throughout the book. It was great. So, I mean, you're pleasantly surprised. But then, you know, there are those who will always sort of fall back to the journalistic mantra of balance, even when there's really not two sides to the story, and, you know, you're always up against that.
What advice, then, do you have for our listeners in trying to sort out these public narratives that they hear? I think as a scientist, I have a better ability to discern, but what about maybe listeners that are not scientists?
Right, and that's a great question because, I mean, I think it's part of the problem, actually, is we believe we can know everything we need to know by Googling the word, in this case, vaccines, and that will put you in front of a lot of bad and good websites. So how do you tell the difference? And I would argue that the websites that are coming from reputable sources like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention or the American Academy of Pediatrics or, you know, university centers or medical centers, those are the ones that you trust. But they're not the ones that come up first. I mean, it's the scarier ones that come up first. And invariably, they're selling something. They're selling cures for autism or cures for attention deficit disorder or whatever. And so you should be suspicious of that. But again, they're generally more attractive. They're the first to come up. Often you have parents telling compelling stories, and it's hard. But, you know, the real answer to your question is one that nobody likes, is that, you know, when somebody calls me and says, look, I've done my research and I've decided not to get, for example, the chickenpox vaccine. Well, what they mean by research is that they've gone on the internet and read people's opinions about the chickenpox vaccine. If you really want to do your research about the chickenpox vaccine, actually, you should read the roughly 300 articles that are out there, which would mean you would have to have an expertise in, you know, virology, immunology, molecular biology, epidemiology, clinical medicine. You would have to have some expertise in that. I mean, most people don't have that expertise. Most doctors don't have that expertise. So really what they do is they rely on groups like the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices to the CDC or the Committee of Infectious Diseases, so-called Red Book Committee to the American Academy of Pediatrics, that at least collectively have that expertise, collectively have read those papers, and give good advice. But that's a hard message in the 21st century, right? Trust us, we're experts. But, you know, the fact of the matter is when people say they're fully informed, they don't really mean that. When we try and say we fully inform our parents, that's really hard to do given the amount of expertise and experience that would be required to be fully informed.
You know, for our listeners, we said it at the beginning of the show, but I want to repeat it now, which is that you are a co-inventor of the rotavirus, the vaccine to protect against rotavirus. What was that like for you, and what did you learn from that that maybe you took forward into this book?
Well, you don't really think you're making a vaccine. I mean, what you do as a scientist is you just want to get your papers published and hopefully your grants funded. I chose rotavirus because it had only been known to be a human pathogen for about 7 years before I started working on it, so there was very little information, especially immunological information. We tried to understand, you know, what parts of the virus make you sick, what parts of the virus induce an immune response which is protective, and then hopefully to create strains that can have the best of both worlds, meaning immunity without pathogenicity, without virulence. And but that was a, you know, 10-15 year process. But you're always just trying to understand the virus. You never think you're making a vaccine, even though that is sort of, you know, the first paragraph of every grant and the first paragraph of every paper, and it is what you're generally heading toward. But I think if you enter science thinking you're making a medical product, you're going to be pretty disappointed most of the time. So you're just sort of thinking, you know, I just want to learn about this, and hopefully that knowledge will lead to this eventual thing happening. But I was just lucky I was in the right place at the right time with the right people to eventually end up being where that ended up being, a medical product.
Excellent. Well, I am just feeling blessed to have been on this interview, and I hope that good advice can gain more traction. As we wrap up, are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, just I think we, you know, I was on service last week, and there was a parent who said, you know, we don't vaccinate our children. I just, it always really upsets me. You know, I think people need to know that a choice not to get a vaccine is not a risk-free choice. It's a choice to take a different and more serious risk, and unfortunately now we are learning what that risk looks like as we've crossed the 1,000 patient mark with measles this year. It is unconscionable. And I just think we are putting a critical number of people are putting their children in harm's way unnecessarily. It's really, really hard for me to watch as a clinician.
Well, we appreciate you putting yourself out there with your new book called Bad Advice, Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Sources of Health Information, and encourage you to talk with your doctors about that information, your pediatricians, your primary care physicians, internists, family docs, specialists. Thank you so much, Dr. Paul Offit, for being our guest today, and we'll put a link up to your book and encourage our listeners to get a copy of it themselves.
Thank you.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Paul Offit, pediatrician, professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, about his recent book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Coming up are our house calls, where we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jimmy Labattle.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health for the house call segment of our show today. We're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions or concerns. If anyone has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send any comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, it's yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first house call question. Laura?
I have a question about sports physicals. My child came in recently to be cleared for playing football, and the doctor noticed he had a history of wheezing when he had an upper respiratory infection in the past. The doctor said he had a little wheeze on the exam, even though I hadn't heard him coughing, and he's been running just fine. My doctor put on the chart that my son has asthma and needed to be followed regularly. This made me angry because I think this will bias his coach in the future, and I'm wondering who's right and what I can do.
Well, I'm not sure, Jamila, and I want to step right in the middle of this one here, but I can understand you as a parent being concerned about a diagnosis being given that's new and potentially lifelong on a medical record. I can understand that that could be concerning.
Yes, I can understand that, but also, there's the safety of the child. There's also, you know, risk to playing when there is a chronic condition that's not controlled.
Right. We see, unfortunately, deaths that were probably preventable each year in sports, and asthma could be one of the things. I mean, you're out in the middle of the summer, or if it's really strong heat, or in those fall nights in football, if you have asthma and it's flaring and you didn't know you had it and you didn't have an inhaler and the coaches didn't know. So we really are talking about safety here. Well, on the other hand, I do think it's reasonable to make a diagnosis perhaps on additional data. So in this particular case, it may be useful to say, what else could the physician have done first to have made a better diagnosis? Like, you probably have ordered pulmonary function tests on patients before.
That's right.
And those are useful to help really say, oh, there's a decline from baseline, and to see that it's asthma. It could have been called that the patient has wheezing and without the diagnosis of asthma. I don't know if that make us feel any better. I think the doctor probably did more or less the right thing in this case, though.
I agree.
Yeah, safety first. Laura, what's our very next house call?
Recently, my 17-year-old and I are like two rams butting heads. He's on an antidepressant, but he continues to smoke marijuana, drink intermittently, and he seems angry almost all of the time. The depression may be better, but he's not obeying our rules about smoking and drinking. What else can we ask our doctor to do for him?
Well, Jamila, you see a lot of people suffering from addiction, so this must be something that's pretty common but difficult.
It's difficult, especially in adolescent populations, but there are other treatment options. First, making sure that there aren't any adverse side effects from the antidepressant, like did this change in behavior happen after the initiation of the antidepressant? Are we seeing some hypomania, mania? And then if at baseline this was happening prior to the antidepressant, then we want to have a substance abuse evaluation and think about therapy as some other treatment options.
I agree with you about having more evaluation done. Let's not just assume this is the natural part of adolescence. And while we think that some experimentation may be a natural part of adolescence, here you have some warning flag. You know, you need some help. You need some, there may need to be a drug screen done. Find out if there's other substances, because if you got marijuana and you got alcohol, you might have opioids, you might have prescription drugs, non-prescription drugs, you might have illegal drugs, other ones, cocaine and other things. I just tend to be worried. And as I tell patients, I get paid to worry.
That's right.
In this particular case, you probably want some other professional help too, right?
Absolutely. This is a multidisciplinary, I think, an opportunity for multiple thinking heads to come together, take a multidisciplinary approach.
Thank you so much for that question. Laura, what's our last house call?
I've heard you talk on the show before about AA and Al-Anon, and I know both are 12-step programs, but I'm not sure what those steps are. Can you briefly describe them to me?
Well, we've talked about Alcoholics Anonymous has a 12-step program to help those who are suffering from alcohol addiction. It's probably the largest and most recognized one in the world. And we've also talked about Al-Anon, which is a similar 12-step program to help those who are family members of people who suffer from alcohol abuse to heal. AA, or Alcoholics Anonymous, was founded by William Griffin Wilson, who died in 1971, and Alcoholics Anonymous now has millions of people worldwide, thousands of groups, associations around the country, and they're really all around the 12-step plan. And the only difference between the Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon is actually in the 12th step. We're actually going to read these steps here and just comment on our understanding of these steps. And people spend months and years working on these steps, mm-hmm. but it is a recognized successful treatment in a field in which there aren't a lot of recognized successful treatments. So this is a good thing for many people. What's the very first step?
So we admitted we were powerless over alcohol or the drug and that our lives had become unmanageable.
can't control it anymore, which is a hallmark of almost any addiction.
That's correct.
But admitting that.
That's right.
Step number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So there's something about that we're acting in ways that perhaps aren't sane, how a sane person might act. And because we, in step one, said we were powerless to control it, then there actually is some other force outside of us that perhaps can restore that.
That's correct. And that force can be what you identify as higher than or greater than yourself.
Number three.
Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him.
And that may be a spiritual force. It may be something, it doesn't have to be religious. A lot of people say, well, I don't like AA because it's religious, but there are many AA groups in which it's about more of a spiritual force. But it is this decision that one is going to allow a greater force in oneself to have a role in one's life. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Whoa. I got to really go look inside myself and figure out what my status is about the moral things that are important to me and how I'm doing. And a lot of people who may be suffering from alcohol addiction may find that very challenging, right?
It's challenging, I think, even if you're not suffering from an addiction. So, yes, absolutely.
Well, then let's go to number five, Jamila. Yeah.
Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs.
Oh, so not only do we have to do that moral inventory, we actually have to tell others there. We have to be willing to be pretty humbling of ourselves, right? That sounds like that, again, could be really difficult but important. And number six, we were entirely ready to have God or the spiritual force remove all these defects of character. None of us are perfect.
That's absolutely correct.
We all hope that we can be better. What's number seven?
Humbly ask Him, meaning the force, the power greater than you, to remove our shortcomings.
So we are ready to remove them, and then we ask for that removal. And number eight, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Oh, that sounds like a good thing, right? I like to do that almost every day.
I was going to say, that's a very important step, similar to kind of moral inventory and admitting your wrongs. That's profound.
Number nine, made direct amends to people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or another. So, you know, I had the list. I've got to be willing to make amends. And then I've got to actually do it, unless me doing it could be really, really harmful. We could think of some circumstances where, you know, it's just not going to work, but at least the attempt to do it to correct the wrongs. What's number 10?
Yep. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted to it.
Okay. So again, this continuous process, we call it in medicine, continuous quality improvement. Here is continuous quality improvement of ourselves. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His or her will, I'm adding the her on there, for us and the power to carry that out. Prayer and meditation, which for most people or a lot of people, one or both of those probably is pretty darn healthy. We know that from our own research.
That's right.
And then number 12.
Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
And in Al-Anon, they just say to practice this, carry this message to other people in Al-Anon. So that's the only difference between Al-Anon 12 steps and alcoholic AA 12 steps. But it's interesting is this belief that these principles can help almost anyone lead a better life, whether one is alcoholic, one has a family member, or just struggling with really difficult things, that these principles really talk about a way of living that may improve life for many people. Again, there are a lot of other steps and programs other than AA. Hopefully, describing it in a little more detail can be helpful. And again, every community really across the country just about has AA meetings that take place that people can go to free of charge.
And for opiate use disorder, NA, which is like the drug abuse version of alcohol.
Naranon for family members or Narcotics Anonymous.
That's right.
NA. And there's all kinds of other ones. Gamblers Anonymous. Mm-hmm. I think there's a sexual addiction one and Hoarders Anonymous and different ones. So, well, that'll conclude House Calls today. And we really want to thank everyone for joining us today for your health. We hope we've address issues that are important to you and your health. You can send us any question yourself to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. I'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle, and our guest today, Dr. Paul Offit. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.